Yes. All right. We're going to cover section 10 in the notes today on stacks. Starting here with slide 2. A stack is really just a variation of a list. It's just a restricted form of a list. You can only access it at one end of the list. And the one end that you access it at is referred to as the top of the stack. It's, from a user's perspective, it's a dynamic structure because the contents of the stack can change during execution. It's usually termed a LIFO structure. Last in, first out, which means the last thing that you push into the stack is the first thing that gets removed, that gets popped. We're going to talk about a single type element stack, not a generic stack, which can hold any type of element. That's for next semester when we start talking about polymorphism. Here are our operations. We have a constructor to initialize the stack, an empty function to tell us whether there's anything in it, a full function to tell us whether we can put anything else in it, a push function to push another item onto the top of the stack, and a pop function which will remove and return the top of the stack. So here's how we would form that stack over at the right by these three push commands upon this fstack object. Some stack implementations will define a top function which will return the top element on the stack but not remove it. And typically in those types of implementations, the pop function will then simply remove the top element but not return it. So you're expected to get the top off before you pop it yourself. Now let's take a sort of a non-trivial application of stacks and discuss them. If you've ever went caving, done any spelunking, you know one of the things that you have to be careful about is that you don't get lost. And a cave is a little bit similar to a maze. And you have to be careful when you're walking around in a maze that you don't get lost. And let's say we want to write a little program to figure its way out of a maze. And we will model the maze by using a two-dimensional binary matrix where we'll just store zeros and ones. We'll let a zero represent a door or a passageway, and one will represent a wall that we can't walk through. And you do have to be careful about walking through them. One of the first early chess programs that I played a long time ago, I was beating the crap out of it, had its king trapped in the corner and was moving in for checkmate when suddenly its king moved to the other side of the board. The program thought it was a valid move, okay? Not quite allowed. At that point I declared the program stupid and I won, okay? If it can't play the game according to the rules, it doesn't get to play. And we must code up our maze program so that our person doesn't walk through walls. That's also not allowed. So, we'll also, to make things, just to keep things simple here, we'll assume that the entrance to the maze is located at the origin of the matrix at 0, 0, and we're trying to get to some MN position down here at the exit. Now, we're going to allow ourselves to move in any of the 8 compass points here. And if you are at some row and column position, in order to get to one of these compass points, like to move northwest, you would have to subtract one from the row and one from the column. So all I've done here on this diagram is listed the offsets that would have to be added to the row and column index to take a step in one of these directions from where you're currently at in the matrix. So, now, one of the problems that we have if we're not careful, besides walking through walls, is that if we're not careful, we might walk off the end of the maze, okay? Which is a bad thing. That would mean we would have an array subscript error. Now, we could include code to check for not only walking through walls, but also to make sure that we don't walk off the end of the board, right? So we check, do all of our range-bound checking. Well, we absolutely must make sure that we can't walk through walls, so we have to include that check. So there's a fairly typical little trick that's done in this case in terms of programming, and that's to basically use the one check to do the same as the other check. So we can use the wall check to make sure that we don't walk off the maze. And the way we'll do that is we will actually represent our maze inside with a bigger matrix. And we'll surround the actual maze representation. We'll surround it with an extra row and column all the way around, and we'll put a wall around the whole thing. That way, we won't accidentally, the check to see, to make sure that we don't walk through a wall, will also prevent us from walking off the maze, because the entire maze will be surrounded by a wall. And that way we don't have to bother with those extra checks for the bounds checking. This is a typical type of game programming trick that's done quite a bit. So our maze then, our m by n maze will actually require m plus 2 times n plus 2 array locations. Our entrance will now be at 1, 1, and the exit will be at m, n. And we'll define two constants called exit row and exit column. Now, we will declare, we need a way, a systematic way to move around this maze. Basically what we will do is we'll take a very straightforward but non-intelligent solution to this problem. We will, starting at some position, we'll try and step in a direction if we can. If we can't, we'll try and step in the next direction. And we'll always try these directions in the same order, which will be north, northeast, east, southeast, etc., as labeled up there. We'll always try them in the same order. Now, if we can step out of a position, then we'll go ahead and take a step in that direction, but we'll also need to keep track of how we left this last maze position, so that if we have to come back to it, we can then pick up with the rest of the positions out of that one. We'll get to that in a moment. But we do have to be systematic, because basically what we're going to do is we're going to just start stepping through here in these orders. At some point we might come to walls that are all the way around us, let's say, except for the position that we come in. We come into a complete dead end. Well, at that point, what would we have to do? We'd have to basically backtrack to our previous position. And then from this previous position, we'd want to try each of the other ways out of this position. We don't want to step right back into the one that we just stepped back out from, otherwise we get into an infinite loop doing this. Okay? So we just then try the next position. We keep doing that, and we might have to back up even further, try the next position out of here. Basically, if we systematically try every position out of every square that we can get to, we will either find the way out, or we'll find that there is no way out. With one provision, and that's that we don't walk around in circles. We got to be careful. We don't walk around in circles. Okay? That's like this book I was reading about this group of cave explorers that were they were exploring this cave, and of course occasionally they would toss their trash down, you know, their bottles of Pepsi, their Frito corn chips or whatever. They were getting hopelessly lost, They knew it. But lo and behold, they were saved because they came upon the tracks of some other people. And so they said, well, we can just follow them out. And then as they went a little bit further, they said, hey, these guys are eating the same things we're eating. Look at the Pepsi, but never mind. You get it. They were basically circling themselves. All right, so we got to make sure we don't do that. Now, so there's several things that we've got to keep track of here. We'll declare an array of move structures. The move structure is just a little record that holds two integers, a vertical offset and a horizontal offset. We'll declare an array of size 8, which will be for each of those compass points, 0 through 7, and we'll initialize it, which I've done there, with those offsets. That way, if we want to step like in direction 4, which means we're going to try and step south, all we have to do is add the offsets that are in move sub 4 to our current row and column position, and that'll move us south. Alright? Now, in order to avoid getting lost, we'll declare a second two-dimensional array called mark. We'll store the maze path that we've already checked. We'll initialize all of the entries of mark to 0. And as we visit a position, we'll mark it to 1. Kind of like, you know, taking a piece of chalk as you're going down in a cave, marking your waves when you come to forks and stuff, so that you don't backtrack. That way, we'll move into a new square. Only, of course, if there's not a wall there, if there's a door there, and provided the square hasn't been marked. Because if we're getting ready to step into a square, and we notice a 1 there, what does that tell us? We've now walked around in a circle, and we're getting ready to step back over a place that we previously visited. And we don't want to do that. Okay? So, Oh yeah, we'll still be able to. The walls will force us to backtrack at that point. Now we may have to backtrack because either we get to a place with all walls around us, or the only way out of the place might be in the squares that we previously visited. And so we don't want to step into those because then we'd be going in circles. So at that point we have to backtrack. Now in order to backtrack, we have to have a way of storing what was our last position before we take a step. We'll use a stack to do that. Well, our stack item will contain a row, a column, and a direction. We'll store three things. We'll store the row and column that we just came from, and we'll store the next direction to try out of it. So, for example, if we're getting ready to take a step into, you know, if we're at XY, and we're getting ready to take a step south, okay? Before I leave here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to push my current XY, and I will also push a 5. Onto the stack, I'll push an X, a Y, and a 5. Why? Because I'm getting ready to step in direction 4, and if I ever back up to here, the next direction for me to try out of here is 5. I'm going to try them in order. So, that will basically represent our previous position and the next direction to try if we have to back up. And we'll just sort of assume that our position item class exists. And the position will contain a row, a column, and a direction. So here's the code to do this on slide 5. It's fairly involved. We've got our maze, which is our two-dimensional matrix. We've got our current row, current column, the next row, next column, a direction to try. We haven't found a solution. Our item position, we'll declare that to be 1, 1, 1. We'll initialize our first position. We're going to start at 1, 1 because we've bounded the array with a wall. And the next position, we'll say the next direction to try will be 1 because 0 is to the north, and that's basically just where we came from to get into it. Although if we try going north out of the 1-1 position, it won't matter because there'll be a wall there because of the bounding of the matrix. So, we'll also declare a second maze called Mark, and we'll set all of it equal to zero. And we will instantiate a visit stack object so that we can push those position objects on it. And the first thing we'll do is we'll mark the 1-1 position as visited because we are now standing in that square. And we will push onto the visit stack, we'll push our current position. That's to prime the stack. We're going to use the stack to help us keep track of how long to keep trying to get out of this maze. So, while the stack is not empty, and we haven't found a way out. Well, we know the stack's not empty initially because we just pushed our current position. So we'll pop that current position, even and we'll set itself back equal to itself, but that's just to get the algorithm started. Then we will we'll get the current row and the current column from that position object. We'll set its direction. We'll get the direction to try. While that direction is less than max directions, while we still have directions to try out of this square, and we haven't found a way out of the maze. So, we then compute the next row and column. Okay, we add to the current row and column the offsets for the direction that we're going to try. We add the vertical and horizontal offsets. And then we check if the next row and the next column is equal to the exit row and exit column, we've just stepped into the solution. And at that point, we can set bound equal to true, and we'll back out of these while loops. Otherwise, we want to see if we can step into this next row and column. So we'll check to see if there's a door there. Door is a constant of zero, and we haven't visited that next row and column. Not mark. Mark is zero, so not mark better be true, right? If that's true, it means that we can step in that direction. So at that point then, we'll mark the next row and column that we're getting ready to step into. We'll mark it as visited. We will then set the row and column for position equal to this current row and column. We will set the direction in position to the next direction. We're now getting ready to step out of the current row and column into the next square by following the current value of direction. If we ever have to come back out of here, if we ever have to come back to the square, we'll need to try the next direction out of here. And we will then push that onto our visit stack. We'll save our old position and the next direction to try out of our old position. Then we will reset our current row and current column to the next row and column. That means that's where we physically take the move, finally. We'll set our direction to zero. We're going to start moving from our new location. So at that point then, we would come back up to the while loop and we would try moving out of this new square. Now at some point, let's say we haven't found the exit row and column, and let's say, of course, the very first time when we set that to zero, most likely we would be right up against the edge of the maze and we wouldn't be able to step north because there would be a wall there. So at that point, we would have to come down to here. We'd add one to direction. So we go up and we add the offset for the next direction. So very methodically, we're going to try each square out of here. Now at some point, if we go by all of the directions, if we try all of the directions, when direction becomes equal to 8, max directions, we know we can't step out of the square. We're in a square, we tried every way out of it, and we can't get out of it. Either because there's a wall there that we're trying to step into, or that other position is marked as visited. So at that point, we have to back up, correct? We're in a square we can't get out of, so we have to back up. That means the inner while loop ends, and we come back up to the outer while loop. Now, what did we do in that inner while loop? We took steps. As we took steps, we pushed the previous position we were at. Now we're going to back up. We're going to pop our previous position off of the stack that we pushed, where we pushed it. We'll reset the current row and current column and direction so that we back up and try the next direction out of this square. Okay? That's pretty much it. The rest is pretty trivial at this point. Here on the slide 6, we could see the output path results. If we found a way out of the maze, if when that while loop finish, when those while loops finish, if found is equal to true, that means we found a way out. And that means that in the vivid stack is stored, as we step from each square to each square, that stored the path. So we can basically output that now. We can go into a little while loop, and while that stack's not empty, we can pop off each position, and we can output them. And that would give us the path out of the maze. Okay? Otherwise, it wouldn't contain a path out. Stacks are quite good for holding backtracking information. And one of the things that they're quite good at. Not too terribly difficult to think about how you would extend this for a three-dimensional maze. How would you extend this program to work for a three-dimensional maze? Huh?
It has more directions to go in.
Yes, how many more? Probably only two. If you're at a position, a three-dimensional maze is like a set of planes, right? It's a set of two-dimensional matrices. So if you're at a position, you can think of it as there's some maybe a circular stairway going up to the next level or down to the next level, or maybe just one way up or down or no way. So you could check to see if you can go up, down, or both directions. And you're, instead of having those eight directions, you're now going to have what? Not only eight, but 10, really. You're going to be at the eight directions on the current plane, and then you can either go up or down. Yeah. Now, we're not going to get tricky. You could get tricky, of course, and you could come to stairs, and stairs lead you up to the next plane, but they go at an angle, so you don't end up at the same XY coordinate on the other one. You could do that. It's not that much more complicated. Well, yeah. But you want to keep it simple to start with. It's not that complicated to extend this into three dimensions. The algorithm will really work. It's not a very intelligent algorithm, okay? It will eventually find its way out. It might starve first before it finds its way out because it's not too intelligent. But it will find its way out if there is a way out. So let's talk about implementing a stack. Here on slide 10.7, here's a stack class interface. We have a constructor, an empty, a full, a push, and a pop function. Now, we're going to represent the items with an array, a stack of some arbitrary item. We don't really care what. And we can have, we'll have a top integer to let us know where the top is at. Now, there are some inefficient ways you could do this. You could say, well, I'm not going to store top. I'm not going to store that as a separate integer. I'll always let the top be the zeroth element in the array. So I'll always know where top is at. But if you do that, that would mean that whenever you push and pop, you'd have to do array shifting. And you'd still have to know how many elements are in the array, so you'd know how many to shift. So that's no good. That's really not very good at all. You can avoid that shifting if you let top really be the last element that you add as you work your way from the beginning of the array, the zero position, towards the end of the array. Push and pop will basically just remove an insert element at the top location, and then decrement or increment pop. Pop basically is a count. It contains the size, the number of elements that's in the stack, which means that its index will be the array location that's one position ahead where the actual top element is stored. Think about it. Arrays begin at zero. So if we want to push the first element, we would put it at array position zero. How many elements would then be in the stack? One. So top would be one, but that one position, that top position would be at top minus one, which is at zero. If there are 10 elements in the stack, they're in position 0 through 9, or top minus 1 is the top element. You could use this for a bunch of different things, like a maze program for the history of your moves. From a user's perspective, this is a dynamic abstract stack. From the implementation perspective, this is a static. This is a static implementation. There is a maximum size by the maximum dimension of that array, and that's the maximum number of elements that the array that the stack can hold. From an implementation perspective, this is not a dynamic implementation. It's a static implementation. From a user's perspective, you know, at least within this range, the size of the stack can grow and shrink. So it's dynamic from a user's perspective, although not from an implementation perspective. If you were only going to store a stack of integers, if you only needed to store integers in your stack, you could get away with one tricky little implementation to avoid storing using another element to store top, would be to store array position 0, store the index of the top position in array 0. That gets a little tricky, but that would mean for an empty stack, you would store 0 in the array 0 position. And then when you would add 1 to the array 0 position and store the element in there, which would be at position 1. Not really all that useful because there's not that many times where you only need to store a stack of integers. Now here on slide 10.8, we have a linked list representation. The underlying implementation is based on a linked list. If we do this, then the top of the stack becomes the head of the list, and push and pop operate only on the head of the list. So we would have our stack, if we graphed it out, would look something like that list diagram there. For the implementation, we can use our linked list class that we previously implemented in here and build the stack class off of it. We can include linkedList.h. We would still have our arbitrary item type that we're storing in there, item.h. Inside our stack is really going to be a linked list object. So we will define a linked list object inside of each stack object. Now that's called aggregation. You'll get to talk more about the full implications of aggregation when you get to 2704, which is object-oriented design next semester, which unfortunately I won't be teaching, so you'll have lesser instructors for it. Like McQueen and those other people. That was a joke. That was a joke. The interface, whether it's implemented as an array of elements or whether it's implemented as a linked list, the interface for the thing wouldn't change. We still have our same interface here, empty, full, push, and pop, but now the implementation changes. Here on slide 10.9 is the implementation of this. For the empty function, and just returns back whether the list is empty. So we just take our list object, which is SDK, and we call the list is empty function on it. If the list is empty, the fact is empty. Full, well, full would be whether or not we can allocate another object. So we'd have to actually try to do some allocation here. If we could allocate something, if we couldn't allocate something, we'd return true that it's full. Otherwise, we would delete what we just allocated and return false. Not a very elegant way to check it, but that's the way the language pretty much forces us to do it. For push, to push an element onto the stack, we just prefix it to the beginning of the list. So we call our prefix node list member function. And for popping it, we go to the head of that list. We get the current data that's ahead, and then we delete the head. We delete the current node, and then we return. And if we wanted to implement pop, we would basically do everything that we just did in pop, except we wouldn't bother to do the delete. That's the way we implement one data structure off of another data structure. We're now making that list that inside, contained inside of the stack object, we're making it behave, for all intents and purposes, as though it was a stack. And for the user of the stack class, they wouldn't need to know anything about the list class. As far as they're concerned, it's a stack and not a list. Here on the next slide is another example of using one data structure to sort of implement and make it behave like another one. If we needed a stack of characters, we could use the string objects that exist in C++ to implement a stack of characters. Inside of our stack object now would contain a string object. The interface would still be the same. The interface is unchanged. Our item type now is going to be a character. We'll either push a character or we'll pop a character. And the implementation here is on slide 10-11. The implementation, it's empty. Well, we call the string empty function. Full, we can check to see if the length of the string is equal to the max size function. There is a max size function in the string class which returns back the maximum number of characters that a string object can hold. For pushing, we'll just concatenate the character onto the end of the string by using the overloaded plus operation from the string class. And to pop an item, since we're pushing onto the end of the string, we'll need to pop off the last one. So we'll get the length of the string. We'll set the character that we're going to return, temp, equal to the character at length minus 1, okay, which is the last character in the string. And then we'll erase, starting at that ith minus 1 character, we'll erase one character, which will erase the last character from the string object. And then we'll just return it. And pop, once again, if we needed to implement it, would do everything except erase. Questions? Well, these last couple of slides here in the stack chapter give you the iterative version of the knapsack problem that we just talked about last time. Remember we talked about how to solve the knapsack problem recursively where we boiled it down to just given an array and a sum and a start position and an end position in the array. We wanted to check to see if there was some collection of elements in that array that added up to that total. And we did it recursively in about, four or five lines of code. Well, here's an iterative version, which unfortunately, as you can see, takes a lot more than four or five lines to do it. It uses a stack to store the backtracking information. We have an enumerated type called status. none, included, excluded. As we start working with each element of the array, either we haven't done anything with it, so it has no status, we'll either try to include it, we've tried to include it, or we will try to exclude it. That's the status. We're going to have a stack. We would need a stack to store these statuses of each of the elements in the array. So what we would do here then, there's our NetStack function. We initialize the status stack by pushing none. To start with, for the start element in the array, we haven't tried yet to include it, exclude it, or anything. So its status is none. So we'll do the following. If we haven't found a solution, we haven't found is false at the moment. If or if total is equal to zero, well, it wouldn't be to start with. If that's true, then of course we would set found to true. We found our solution, total is equal to zero, and this would be, we basically would keep popping off of the stack because we're done at that point. And we'll be decrementing start, working our way back towards the beginning of the array. Otherwise, we'll check to see if total is negative and the status of the top is equal to none, which basically means that we've come to a negative, we've accidentally decremented our total to be a negative number, and we haven't tried to do anything with the current element. If that's, or if start is greater than n, then there can't be a possible solution with the current selections. In which case, we'll decrement start to back up, and we will pop off the status of that element, which we didn't do anything with. Otherwise, what we'll do here is we'll check to see if the top is equal to none. Now, the first time, that would be true. The top of the status would contain none. So at that point, we would decrement total by race of start. We would pop off the none because we've now tried to include this start element, and we'll push included onto the stack for the start element, and we'll add one to start. We'll move start up to the next one, and we'll push none onto the stack because we haven't tried to do anything with it. It has no status yet. And then we would come back up, and most likely we would come right down to this if statement again, and we'd try to decrement the second one. Okay? We would try and reduce total by the second one. We would pop off the none to the second one. We would push include if we tried to include the second one. We would add one to start, and we'd push none to the next one. And we would keep doing that until either we come to a negative number or something. Now, let's say we then come to a negative number as we're doing that. As we come to a negative number, and the stack top would be none, we'd have to back up. So we'd back up, we'd decrement start, and we would pop off that none. Now the next time that we come through our do while loop then, we would check if the top of the status is equal to none. Well, it wouldn't be. What it would be is equal to included. We just backed up to one that we previously included, but by including it, we ended up with a negative total. So now we'll try to exclude, since we previously tried to include this one and we didn't find a solution, we'll now try to exclude it. We'll increase total back by this amount of this start element that we previously decreased it by. We'll pop off the included status for this element off of the stack, and we'll push and exclude it. Then we'll add one to start to bypass this one, and we'll push none back on. And then we'll go back through this process again. The only other option would be that we might, as we keep doing this, we might eventually come upon one where it doesn't have a none status. We haven't tried to include it. We previously tried to exclude it. So at that point, if we previously tried to exclude it and we still haven't found a solution, we've got to back up even further to a previous element. At which point then we would decrement start, pop off the status, and just go back further. We keep doing this as long as that status stack is not empty. Now, that's a fairly complex, iterative solution to a problem which is solved trivially with recursion. And that's where you get to see the power of recursion. Because it's a lot easier to solve the NetSpec problem recursively than it is iteratively. Okay, get here early for the test on Thursday.